changes in land use. The goal of these next two talks is to wrap up everything we've seen in terms of field data, site-specific data, modeled data of current and future bioenergy crops, and have some idea here of how those estimates are used to answer national questions, which you'll be addressing related to the ESA Act, Energy Independence Security Act of 2007. As a side, is Scott Malcolm here right now? Okay, because he is the last speaker and I do not have his presentation at this time. So Chad, you may be the last one. Make it a good one. Yes.
Thanks. Okay, as you can see, I've changed the title of the discussion. At first, I was going to do it on ESA, the effects of ESA on land use change and biomass supply, but it's that would be irrelevant because what they're doing actually today in Congress, they're doing the markup on the new climate change bill, and it has the potential to completely change the landscape of where we thought biomass was going to be produced and the mix of biomass feedstocks and the availability. So what we've been working on the last few months is hurrying up, trying to get a model capable of analyzing the ESA and the climate change bill together. And I'm just going to give you the what we've been doing kind of hot off the presses. So to overview, the carbon legislation that is coming could change the landscape of biomass potential in several ways. Biomass crops may receive incentives for building soil carbon, and residue harvesters may receive incentives for not harvesting residues. That's one of the big conflicts in the policies is we have one policy saying you're going to remove residues and draw down those carbon levels, and then the carbon legislation is saying we need to reduce atmospheric carbon by putting it into the soils. So there might be something like that in the legislation. Also, higher input crops will see costs rise relative to lower input crops. So we've been using the model last couple months to answer a few questions. Will ACES, that's the climate bill, the America's Clean Energy Security Act, a lot of securities. Will ACES help or hinder fulfilling of the ESA standard, that's the 36 billion gallons by 2022? Will ACES alter the geography of biomass supply potential? Will ESA help or hinder reducing atmospheric carbon? And are there conflicts or synergies between the two policies? To do this, within our socioeconomic model of PolySys, we've integrated two different modules, the biomass module, which we've used in the past with the 25-25 group or on the Governor's Coalition to simulate biomass potential. Right now, we have switchgrass, poplars, willows, crop residues, and woody residues. Not forest land, not forest, but woody residues, thinnings and such. The model works at the county level, and we have county level yields of the biomass crops and residue constraints. And the model works, we put in an exogenous level of ethanol demand, and the model can incrementally increase the cost of feedstocks until that demand's met. And we've made some assumptions on land use, and we made the assumption that pasture can convert if forage is made up through intensification. We think there's a lot of underutilized pasture, and there's great potential in intensive grazing for getting more cattle per acre on smaller parts of land. So that could happen simultaneously. The carbon module, I've been working with Tris the last few years to get this up and going, and it links market carbon price to local crop and land sequestration rates, and links the carbon price to actual embodied carbon in the crop production inputs. I guess since I have some time, I can go over the methodology here quickly of the carbon module. Basically, we have a LP that solves at the county level, and we use NASA data. We know how many, say, corn acres are in one county. but we don't know where in the county they are, so the land cover data allows us to know. You know, to overlay that, and we can have a more precise estimation of where those, say, corn acres are. And then you overlay the soil data, and we find out information on the soils underlaying those corn acres. That gives us a better estimation of specific sequestration rates for each crop in each county, and also each tillage type. And to this module, we've recently added carbon sequestration ability of switchgrass, poplars, and willows. As Tris said earlier, there's a lot of uncertainty here because this is new. Hadn't been a whole lot of field trials. But we got some numbers in there based on about 10 or 15 papers that we've looked at. So basically, this methodology, we can have a dollars per acre incentive level unique to each county, incentive level for the farmers to induce them to adopt the carbon sequestration methods, practices. On the other side of the climate bill is the embodied costs, and in our model we have over 3,000 operation budgets, regional operation budgets, that lists specifically what quantities of inputs are used and what type. And we worked with Richard Nelson at the University of Kansas State and with Tris to get the embodied energy in those inputs. So we know the carbon, embodied energy and embodied carbon, so we know, and this allows us, if carbon prices are increasing, to raise the cost of production based on its embodied carbon. So once we have those in the model, we've added them to the PolySys socioeconomic model, and this is the structure and flow. We can shock it. It affects the, a linear programming model for each county, and it affects the revenues and the costs, so it affects the ranking of the net present values of the crops competing in each county. So it changes the farmer's decision making, which goes to the national level, changes national production, and through market clearing conditions and elasticities we have in the model, it will result in new crop prices, and those crop prices will affect the next year's planting decisions of the farmer. And what's kind of unique about PolySys is it solves annually, so we can track any kind of a lot of data coming out of the model. We can track the transition period over time, year by year. So to look at, to evaluate the merging of these two policies, we have several scenarios. One's baseline without ESA, where we just extend USDA baseline in 2030. Next one is ESA. It's in blue because that's the only one that's actually mandated right now. We meet the 36 billion gallons. And then we have a few where we the carbon climate change policies is very vague right now as far as what's going to be included for offsets. So we've incrementally increased what we believe are realistic possibilities. Number one, carbon offsets to reduction in tillage intensity. And then the next scenario, we add carbon offsets to perennial grasses. And then the next one, a possibility because of the conflict in the policy, there might be something where residue harvesting is constrained to the carbon neutral level. They can remove residues, but just to the neutral level. And so these are the results on net carbon flux. You can see the black line is the baseline there without ESA. The blue line is with ESA. The increase is a little bit with increased corn plantings, but then once the herbaceous crops come in, the net flux to the atmosphere decreases. This is a good thing. Now, this is not, right now the model does not include losses of soil carbon from residue harvesting, so it's probably realistically in between the black line and the blue line. The other two scenarios with when we add grasses, tillage and grasses, it reduces net carbon flux a little bit more, but the clear winner here is the residue carbon neutral scenario. And that's because it's throwing the burden of meeting ESA onto the herbaceous grasses. So we're not removing residues anymore. Those lands are sequestering carbon. But also the big boon comes from more acres of herbaceous grasses that are putting more carbon into the soil. And this was kind of surprising when it came out, when we did the simulations. Bottom line there is the baseline without ESA. net returns to farmers. And you can see just ESA by itself is a huge boon for farmers. It raises net returns a lot to farmers. And the two scenarios where you add offsets to tillage or grasses increase it a little bit more there. But once again, the big winner here is residue carbon neutral actually increases net returns even higher. And that's because it seems a little counterintuitive, but by restricting residue removal, the burden of ESA is on grasses, more land has to come into production. So crop prices rise a little bit, and so farmers are increasing net returns for all crops, even if they're not in the herbaceous or residue harvesting, their net returns go up for growing corn or soybeans. Now that results in a slightly higher price, but it's still within the realm of feasibility, $58 a dry ton for biomass. So because it's so vague, we're really looking at the possibilities, and we feel that the front runner right now is this last one, where there's going to be offsets to tillage, to herbaceous grasses, and residues will be constrained to the carbon neutral level. So what will happen if this policy is adopted to biomass supply availability and potential? And to do that, I'm going to show you a few maps of the regional results. Pictures speak 1,000 words. So this is ESA alone, no carbon, no climate bill. And then this is what happens if you add the climate bill with our front-running scenario. I'll go do back again. So it really drastically changes the geography of residue supply.
And what are the main reasons for that again?
Because a lot of this land is they're removing residues, but it's lowering the carbon value. So they have to restrict the removal of the residues. Say up in Montana, there that they can only pull off a little bit, and that's not economically feasible just to pull off that little bit, so the farmers don't do it at all. And they'd rather take the incentive for no-till carbon sequestration and not remove residues at all. So it's basically confined under the climate bill to areas that are really flat and high productivity. So those farmers, it's still worth it to remove the residues and not take the incentive. This is with total biomass production. This is with herbaceous grasses and crop residues. This is ESA alone. And then with the front-running climate scenario, you can see it drastically changes it. There's a concentration of biomass in the plain states with herbaceous grasses. You can see in Iowa and Illinois the reduction of crop residues. Okay, this is what's going on with soil carbon. This is what will make it so attractive to people interested in climate reduction and increases in soil carbon. This is ESA alone, so we're still meeting the 36 billion gallons, but without the climate bill. And this does not have, this is not showing there's likely residue losses from residue harvesting, but we don't have that information in the model yet, so we're just assuming it's zero if they're removing residues. And this is under the new climate front running. So you can see there's a huge increase in soil carbon in our ag lands. Carbon payments, this is where the carbon payments are going in our front running scenario. Really intense along the plain states there, where there's a lot of herbaceous grasses, and also where there's still some residue harvesting going on. And this is the interesting and at first counterintuitive outcome. This is a change in net returns from ESA alone to the front running scenario with residues constraining the carbon neutral. You'd think that these areas like in Iowa and Illinois that were really simulated before, projected to harvest a lot of crop residues, you'd think that their net returns would go down. But by but by being restricted, they're taking the carbon incentive for no-till, but also the burden is on herbaceous grasses. Takes a little bit more land out of crop production, raises all crop prices, and they actually benefit from it. Okay, so in conclusion, there's a few points of interest. ESO alone could deliver great carbon and net returns benefits just by itself without a carbon, a climate bill. But soil carbon offsets to herbaceous biomass enhance both carbon and farmer benefits. And restricting residue harvesting to the carbon neutral has a positive impact upon carbon benefits and net returns. And so in conclusion, the climate bill, ACEs, could it really alter the geography of feedstock availability, possibly more toward herbaceous grasses and away from crop residues. So in conclusion, I'd say that the estimates of feedstocks could be in for a big shift if it's already passed the House and the Senate's taking it up today. It's very vague, so we don't really know what's going to be in it, but I think what's going to have to be in the climate change legislation is going to have to be something that satisfies farm states. They're politically very, very powerful in this, and especially those farm states with Democratic representatives. So if they can satisfy them, I mean, they're going to be looking for things in the legislation that benefit farmers. So that's why we picked that one as the front runner. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Chad. I have one quick question for you, and that is how does you are not simulating anything to do with woody crops here. Would that change?
I didn't say woody crops because, but they were in the model. They came in slightly in the high, the one where the prices went up to $58 a dry ton. But we see them coming in above $55 and coming in a lot at $60 or $70 a dry ton.
Okay. Any other questions for Chad?
Made some big assumptions the big thing is underutilized pasture coming in. So like the acres coming in the final scenario, I believe there's 30 million acres of cropland switching over to switchgrass, and then 60 million acres of pastureland switching over to switchgrass.
There's a second question.
Addressing what you just said, isn't there going to be other constraints from changing cropland to biofuels that we've been hearing about, just because we're legislating them produce 36 billion gallons in climate change, but as far as food security and a lot of other issues, I would think that we just can't convert all that cropland to switchgrass.
Is there going to be other constraints, like on the cropland or the pasture land?
On the cropland.
On the cropland.
Yeah.
I think the constraints would be economic, right? Because there's owners of that land, and if they see it's profitable to put it into grasses, they would do it. And with the yield increases that are projected in USDA, we don't see prices increasing that much by taking 30 million acres out of cropland.
Right answer.
the 36 billion gallons mandated by 2025, 15 billion gallons is going to come from corn ethanol, the other 21 billion gallons is going to come from a combination of advanced and cellulosic renewable fuels. And under the RFS2 program, it had a net greenhouse gas reduction mandate, so 50% reduction and a 60% reduction to qualify for either advanced or cellulosic. Does that take into account those net reductions? Do you have a life cycle analysis, a model built into that?
Yeah, well, we keep corn at 15 billion gallons, and the rest is made from cellulosic, and we're assuming it's going to meet the standards for greenhouse gas emissions.
So you're not following it through the whole upstream and then downstream conversion.
No, I mean, that's not in the model. Okay. We just rely upon other studies that say that switchgrass is good at meeting that. I don't know.
Stay there, Chad. Is Scott Malcolm here? If he's not here, we'll continue the questions. If he's here, okay. Next question.
I was just curious on your pasture part. I mean, because I can't even begin to imagine all the assumptions you had to make, actually. But on the pasture one, the thing you said that was kind of intriguing early in your talk is you said that the assumptions you made on the pasture was that due to some changes in grazing habits or you assume some pretty significant yield increases using management intensive grazing and things like that. And I'd just be curious to know how you did that, especially in conjunction with climate, in particular precipitation, since it's not, there probably would be a pretty good debate as to whether or not you don't always get a significant increase just by changing grazing practices over to mid as opposed to say, continuous grazing, for example. And, it's especially, and that's especially true as you would get into drier, more semi-arid or arid regions of the country.
Mm-hmm. In the model, we have assumptions on intensification, and I threw out the cattle thing, but in the model, the way it works, if you bring in an acre of switchgrass, you have to make that up in intensification of forage production. So for an acre of switchgrass that comes in, we look at the hay yield, and we bring in like a half an acre based on the yield ratio of forage to hay. We bring a half an acre of intensive hay to make up that lost forage that we're bringing in from the pasture. But that's just one way to think of it. That's the way it works in the model. But it could also be a reality, and I think it's maybe a truer outcome in the future, is there will be intensification. Rather than bringing in that acre of hay, we'll have intensification in livestock production through intensive grazing. I've read a lot in the last few years on the possibilities of intensive grazing. I've seen some in East Tennessee. I've been to a couple farmers' land where with small paddocks and rotating the 15 or 18 paddocks, and then those grasses grow really high before you put the cattle on, and they're getting a lot more animals per acre.
But it's still limited by moisture. That's my point. That doesn't work in all geographies.
Say like in Western Kansas, it wouldn't work.
Right. I mean, and so you can see that pretty commonly, especially in the eastern half of the U.S. But there are other areas where, I guess that would be my point. What does, I mean, management intensive grazing from continuous grazing, that part I understand. Mm-hmm. But even saying intensification of, say, hay, of a haying system, I guess I'd be curious to know how you define that. Because even that is still moisture limited. And so I guess I'd be curious to know if moisture limitations were brought into the model, because that's going to come, you know, as you get into the northern Great Plains or the central plains and going west, moisture becomes probably one of your most limiting factors.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's a particularly good point because it emphasizes the need to couple a lot of the economic models with the biophysical models. And while there's a number of research groups that continue to try to do that, I think we've got a long way to go on that end. Is there any other questions? Atul in the back?
Yeah. I was wondering about, do you also look at the nitrogen cycle in terms of N2 or what happened in the case of higher carbon sequestration in the soil? What happened to N2 or NOx other emissions?
No, we didn't look at that. Even as a possible offset to?
No, offset or maybe onset?
No, we didn't look at the nitrogen cycle.
There are, I know that we have greenhouse gas budgets, including N2O, associated with all of the agricultural budgets. And I don't, was that included?
Yeah.
As a carbon equivalent in your output?
Yeah, we have that as a carbon cost.
Okay.
Yeah. So I guess it's in there.
Okay.
I was going to observe that exactly that same Iowa, Illinois area that you said showed some interesting changes in potential is one of the areas that the some of the climate change scenarios suggest are going to receive more precip. So
okay.
I don't know how that interplays with the model.
Yeah.
The Southwest is generally going to receive less, but that's one of the few parts of the country that's predicted to receive more, as much as you can believe the model projections.
Okay. Interesting.
At Oak Ridge, with one of the largest supercomputers in the world and probably one of the largest climate change simulation research programs that's hooked into the community climate model, we are only just now starting to link those climate projections with the bioenergy estimates, and that's an entirely different effort, but one that's very important.
I've been somewhat curious on your process model. How is it, use a fixed yield rate for like herbaceous crops across the United States? Because you know, your old publications for policies would show that in the panhandle of Nebraska and eastern Montana would show a large conversion of herbaceous perennial crops,
yeah,
which is highly unlikely based on water limitations. Even if you look at some of the maps, it looks like in parts of South Dakota where you have a kind of ridge reservation, you're looking at short grass prairie, you got about maybe 1,000 or 2,000 pounds per acre of nutrient biomass that's on that. It looked like on some of the maps there was a large influx of bioenergy crops growing in that region. How does your model calculate your yield? I mean, does it vary by precipitation gradient? Because it seems like it's getting better, it looks like, because you're getting closer to the 100th meridian, but it seems like you're still overestimating potential in the western parts of the United States and the Central Plains.
Well, we see a lot, in the model, we see a lot of land coming in those western areas because the opportunity costs are a lot lower because you have a lot of wheatland that's not hugely productive like cornland in Iowa is. So you get a lot of conversion there. The yields, it's always been a source of contention. We have new yields in the model now from, I got them from Bob Perlock at Oak Ridge, and the model you guys ran last year, we have an upland and a lowland yield for every county. They've estimated it at the yield at a pixel level, with maybe Tris can talk more about.
Well, one thing I can say quickly is irrigation is a big factor. When we're trying to model yields across the U.S., how do we model that? Do we use a natural yield? What is a natural yield? Do we try to model what? For instance, I talked to an individual last year at this conference who is getting the highest yields of switchgrass I've ever seen in the country in a dryland area in Washington State. How are you getting those? Well, I'm irrigating like crazy. Okay, so are they really going to irrigate those lands for switchgrass, or are they not going to irrigate them? And do we include those high yields in the national average? These or the national estimations of switchgrass? These are good questions, and They're simply questions we have to consider as we continue to revise these yield estimates across the nation for switchgrass and other energy crops. Peter, if this is for Chad, this is the last one, because I've got to let him off the hook. He's had more questions than anybody else in the symposium.
I was just going to chime in and say, for what we did, which was a much simpler approach, we assumed no irrigation for any biomass feedstocks.
So they simply...
basically trying to set a boundary on the places you need irrigation are places where water is already a challenge, and we were trying to put some fairly firm sideboards on.
Right. But what's come up several times is water limitation. Is water limitation in the models? And regardless of what we're doing as in our individual research, that's a topic that we all need to look at and consider how we're going to do that and probably come to agreement. Atul.
It's not only the water limitation. I think there are a lot of limitations when we do this yield modeling. You know, the radiation is another issue. Washington State, you mentioned.
Right.
There is enough.
Chad, sit down.
Precipitation, we have noticed that there's not enough radiation because of the cloudiness. So this is one of the constraints, another constraint. Nutrients is another issue. Climate change is another issue. You see the yields changes year to year depending on the conditions, water conditions, drought conditions. So
yes.
These are all the issues actually we should consider about, you know, concern about when we do this model.
I would agree. Those interactions are very important. As you know, they are also very important in terms of the biogeochemistry and the greenhouse gas emissions. But when we can't even get the yields with the current cultivars and we're using data from 20 years ago, we've got a lot of really basic research to do before we start even looking at those complex interactions. A couple more questions before we close.
Same theme. I think ultimately you're going to have to bite the bullet and allocate available water around the model, perhaps optimizing it, perhaps being realistic in how far you can exchange it.
Yes. The two biggest things I've heard in terms of water that continue to come up are water availability. There should be some inputs in terms of groundwater precipitation and how much water the crops are going to use. That's one thing. Then you move into the climate change, which is what's the overall impact of evapotranspiration on the water cycle in the region. Those are two things that I'm not familiar with research groups that are looking into them or who is funding those right now, but that those are clearly items of interest. A last question, does somebody want to have the last word today? No. Okay, go ahead.
Right. I think that some of the new crop, energy crop, people probably grow it and apply a lot of nitrogen to get the higher yield. But for those of hay yield you got from statistics, like Montana, people grow the hay the pasture, no input, that's why so many years and no yield increase. So based on those, I think a little bias to use of the yield data. You can grow annual crop or with input in Montana, we can easily grow 10 times with irrigation. But in dry land, hay production only get a time to two times.
Yes, that's a good point. And it really comes back to regional management and how we are going to represent regional management in these national estimates. There's certainly an effort, there's certainly coordination with the Ag Extension offices and the management data and yields. To what extent we can do a better job, I'm not sure at this point, but input like that is helpful. I think that's it for today. It's been a long session since 9 a.m. I appreciate everyone coming and all the input. It's been very useful. Let's thank the speakers one last time.